The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for February 11, 2017. Before we begin, let me remind you that Radiothon 2017 starts right now. Our theme this year is Staying Alive, and we're asking for your support to help fund the station for 2017 and beyond. A substantial cut in the operating budget from the university has made this year's Radiothon results matter even more. Our goal for the event, which starts today, February 11th, and runs through next Sunday, February 19th, is a whopping $50,000. And every donation counts, regardless of how small. Please help show your support for independent college radio, the Outspoken Cyclist radio show and podcast, and help us to stay alive. Log on to www.wjcu.org and use our secure server to make your pledge or call 216-397-4438 and make your pledge to a real human. Just let them know it's in the name of the Outspoken Cyclist. And now on to our regular show. This week, our bicycle world lost one of its most beloved and respected icons when Chris Cagle from Wisconsin succumbed to the aggressive and rare liver cancer with which he was diagnosed last year. To say that Chris was an icon barely scratches the surface of his contributions to not only the bicycle world, but to the world around him. So in an effort to convey what he contributed, I reached out to his friend and colleague Roger Bird, who will give us a bit more in-depth look at who Chris Cagle was and what his legacy will be. We will also speak with Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democratic senator from Ohio. And even though the election is over, it seems that every aspect of government is in turmoil. And I wanted to talk with our senator about what he thinks might actually transpire when it comes to the campaign promises about infrastructure and jobs. Then we'll catch up with Don Walker as he prepares for his 13th North American Handmade Bicycle Show this year in Salt Lake City. Not only is the venue new, but there'll be some new exhibitors and seminars. Finally, we're going to talk with Greg Seipel. On the eve of his retirement as the force behind adventure cycling for over 40 years, Greg walks us back through the organization's history and how he and his wife, June, started the organization and what he will be doing going forward into retirement. Let's begin with my conversation with Chris Cagle's good friend, Roger Bird. Hello, Roger. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thank you for taking time to join me today and share your thoughts and feelings about our mutual friend, Chris Cagle. How and when did you meet Chris?
I met Chris about 15 years ago. I'd worked for Trek Bicycles for almost 20 years, and he was one of our bigger and better customers. He was also pretty local. His business was in Milwaukee, less than an hour away from the headquarters at Trek. So got to know Chris pretty well over the years, but yeah, 15 years.
Yeah, so he, of course, was one of my colleagues. I was a retailer for many years, and people looked to Wheel and Sprocket and the work that they did sort of as a way to move forward because he was such a forward-thinking guy and such a great guy. He was larger than life. What can you tell us about him from your personal perspective, not just from the business world?
Yeah, he, you know, definitely larger than life. You know, one of the beautiful things about Chris is, you know, he ran a great business and did a very good job and was very successful at Wheel and Sprocket. But that energy and the focus and the tenacity that he had for the business, I feel really existed in his personal life. I mean, he wasn't faking anything. He wasn't acting one way at work and then changing at home. He raised 4 amazing children and has a couple grandkids through his stepdaughter. And, you know, he's just a guy that really cares about people and puts people as the most important thing in his sights. He did that during his business with his customers, but casual acquaintances and friends that he meets along the way and his extended family, I mean, he was just an amazing guy who really, really cared about people. And you know it right away. You learn it the minute that you meet him, just the biggest smile, very genuine. And, you know, he always has gone out of his way for people. So really special.
Yeah, he was special. And I read his son posted a note that said, you know, at the last moment, Chris looked at him and said, "Have I done enough for you? What else can I do for you?" And it was such a selfless kind of comment. You know, he was just an amazing person. And when he got sick, I think the entire country, everybody in the bicycle world tried to rally around. And certainly the Wisconsin community did amazing things. They put on that big ride. And now they've posted this big billboard. I don't know if you saw it. Did you see the billboard?
Yeah, I did.
It showed up today. So I know he left a big legacy. What do you think are his most important gifts, both to the community and to the people who knew him?
Well, sorry.
It's okay. Take a moment. I mean, I'm in the same state, unfortunately. I cry on this show occasionally.
Well, his biggest gift is his children.
It's interesting. I don't know them.
You know, Julian, who wrote the letter, you know, wrote the note on Facebook. His oldest son, Noel, who has pretty much been running Wheel and Sprocket for a while. His older daughter, Amelia, who runs the marketing, and his younger daughter, Tessa. All 4 of them are just amazing people. And me as a father, my kids are still teenagers, but I only wish that the one thing that I could give to this world is children. My children are half as good, half as great as Chris's kids are. And they carry on the legacy. You know, they act like Chris and, you know, they're each their own people. But, you know, the outspokenness, the joyfulness and the work ethic is present in all 4 of them. And it's really special. I mean, as a parent, you kind of look at some other kids and some other parents in other situations. And not all of the kids turn out okay. And, you know, Chris has 4 amazing kids, 2 amazing stepdaughters, you know, 2 amazing grandchildren. And just it's a real treat to look at that. And I'm in awe. You know, I really am. I remember when my dad died 9 years ago, it was kind of the same thing. I think my dad was harder on himself than Chris was. You know, he thought he made a lot of failures as a parent, but I just poo-pooed all that and tried to tell him he was full of it. But, you know, I think, you know, Chris was looking back and just making sure that he did enough, at least for Julian. And clearly he did.
How do you think the community is going to carry on his legacy? Because obviously they will. There's so many things he did there. from the bike fed to building trails to riding cross country. He did so many things.
Yeah, I think a lot of what his legacy will be is the continuation of what he calls the good work. I mean, you do what you think is right. You fight for what you think is right. And, you know, great things happen eventually. And, you know, he's done a lot of great work and I think got a lot of things going and kept a lot of things going. And that momentum is still there. And so I think all of the great things that he's been involved with will continue because everyone involved was so passionate about it. But then there's, you know, hopefully going to be a whole nother level of trying to continue with his legacy with the Chris Cagle Foundation and trying to keep some of that magic alive, even with Chris being gone.
Well, obviously he is living on in his work and in his children and in his contribution to the community. We are all mourning his loss. And thank you so much for sharing your story about Chris with me today. I appreciate it. And when you see his children, you tell them that the bicycle industry is 1,000% behind them.
Will do. Thank you so much. I appreciate spreading the word.
Thank you. All right. You have a good day. Thanks.
You too.
Bye-bye. Roger Bird, a good friend of Chris Cagle's for many years, shared some of his memories of Chris with us. As we all said, the industry is mourning his loss. He was bigger than life. He was just this amazing man. We're going to take a moment. We'll be back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to head down to Washington, D.C. to the Senate radio station to speak with the Democratic Senator from Ohio, Sherrod Brown. Good morning, Senator Brown. Thanks for your time today. So it's been a long time since we've talked, and I'm happy to have the opportunity.
Thank you, and me too.
Yeah, so I know there's so much turmoil and a lot of issues on the table right now. I'd like to address infrastructure. And I know there were huge promises made during the campaign last year, and there's a lot of knee-jerk reaction to things such as immigration and national parks and Wall Street. Where does infrastructure sit right now? What's going on, if anything?
Well, a group of Democrats, so six of us, actually wrote an infrastructure bill similar to what the president talked about. He wanted $1 trillion in infrastructure over 10 years. We wrote a bill to do that. We wrote a bill that will be funded. It's a proposal that we think the president could adopt. I mean, it's got Buy America provisions. It has will have good environmental standards in it, so you have to actually make sure the infrastructure is built in the best possible way. It will have investment in communities. It's everything. It's highways, bridges, public housing, community colleges. That's what infrastructure is. It's bike paths. It's everything. It's what infrastructure, good, solid public works from the 40s to the 80s. We led the world. Nobody had ever done anything like that. And we've let it atrophy. We've let it disintegrate. We've not even kept it up. And it's essential that we do that investment sooner rather than later. The president really hasn't moved on at all. I'm hopeful he does. I know there's a lot of resistance in the Republican Party for any of that, but we're ready to go.
Why would there be resistance when everybody, and I remember Secretary LaHood used to say, it's a nonpartisan issue. So why would there be resistance? I thought.
Well, it became a partisan issue because Republicans don't want to spend money. I mean, Republicans want to spend money on tax cuts. They want to spend money on defense. But other than that, they don't really, they've changed in the last 20 years. When Ray LaHood said that, he was a moderate Republican that had just joined the president, President Obama's cabinet, if I remember when he said that, and, you know, a dozen years ago, well, 9 years ago, eight, 9 years ago. And Republicans have changed in the last several years. They blocked any efforts that we could bipartisanly do on, on infrastructure. And it's more an investment than spending money, because you invest in the foundation for economic growth. If you had, there's a bridge in Cincinnati across the Ohio River. 4% of GDP crosses that bridge every day, because it's a whole bunch of interstates coming together towards Cleveland, Columbus, Toledo, Detroit, down south to Louisville, Atlanta, ultimately. And we should look at it as investment. And you do that right, you end up having much better economic growth and more prosperity. They just see it as spending public dollars, and they're just wrong on it.
Well, and what about jobs? I mean, that was a huge component of everybody's campaign, get people working, and public works gets people working.
There are fewer things we can do that both create jobs immediately in the trades, good-paying, mostly union jobs in construction, and obviously production of materials, building the steel and iron. I mean, President Trump, in a number of his construction projects for his buildings, would outsource, he would buy the steel and iron from other countries. Off in China, but we will not let that happen on this infrastructure. But so you have job creation, as you say, Donnie, you have job creation with the building trades, building the roads, and the bridges and the water and sewer systems and the bike paths and all. And then you have, obviously, the construction materials made here. And then you set the foundation for much better economic growth, because companies want to locate in places where they can get their employees can get to work easily and quickly and safely, and their products can get out to the markets efficiently and quickly. And that's why we were so successful. One of the reasons we were so successful as an economy from World War II into the 1980s.
So I have two more real quick questions. One is about the EPA and the health of it and whether it will survive, because, you know, as we ride and walk and don't use cars, but rather public transportation, the environment becomes a really important, and for our next generations, the environment is so important. Clean air, clean water, clean soil. What's going to happen?
Well, the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, the one the president's nominated, who probably will win on a mostly party line vote, because Republican senators I can feel that here. I can see a number of Republican senators would like to vote no on some of these nominees, but they're afraid of an attack from Trump. There are three senators in the Senate right now, Cruz, Rubio, and Graham, who ran against now President Trump, then candidate Trump in the primary, and he went after them personally and attacked them, and his people attacked them. And that message is clear, that that's what will happen to Republicans that break with this president on significant things, on close votes. And that's why I think the EPA administrator will likely be confirmed. He's terrible on environmental issues. He's a climate denier. He's totally been in the pocket of the oil industry. He, even his attorney general, took language and letters from oil companies, and he would write his own letters on Attorney General of Oklahoma stationery with the exact language. He did that a number of times. I worry about him protecting the air and the water. You know, when you live where we do, Diane, in northern Ohio, some of us are old enough to remember what Lake Erie looked like in the 60s.
Yep,
into
me.
The 70s before, yeah, and I am too. I didn't want to say that, but okay. And you know what we did. And it wasn't, the Cleveland Health Department could not have done it by itself with Toledo and Ashtabula, and the state of Ohio couldn't have done it. It needed a strong U.S. EPA. You needed a central government that could put the resources and pass the rules and laws to clean up the lake. I mean, it took that to stand up to the chemical industry and the steel industry and the polluters, and to spend the dollars necessary to clean the lake through the Army Corps of Engineers, all those things that we don't need to talk about. But the point is that this lake, we have done remarkably important and good work cleaning up Lake Erie. We have to do more. I'm very worried about a number of things, because our lake is so much shallower than the other Great Lakes and so much more vulnerable to pollution and to runoff and to all kinds of contaminants. But that just tells me you need an EPA that cares about this. I know the career people at EPA do, and I know most of them are staying there and will resist some of the awful things the director probably will do. But this is an ongoing fight. We will lose, likely, in stopping his confirmation, but we're not stopping any more than when we lost on the Secretary of Education. We're going to keep our eye on her to make sure she doesn't undermine public schools. And that's what this administration is all about, in too many ways.
So my last question has to do, I know you're our senator here in Ohio. You still represent a huge swath of the country just by your views and your support in certain things. How can our listeners let legislators know what they want without all the sort of craziness that's going on social media?
Well, I've been amazed at how, first of all, President Trump has been worse than I thought he would as a president so far. I mean, there's some things he's done that I like, but by and large, he is, it just, his behavior, his demeanor, his unevenness, the chaos in the White House, his incompetence and inability to lead and to pull people together. Already the disloyalty clearly in the White House. I've never seen anything like that, but put that aside. It's clear to me that I see more opposition already, and the opposition takes a lot of forms, protests, letters, calls, people stopping me in grocery stores and at Dave's or whatever in Garfield. But I think it needs to take the form, and people volunteering for my campaign in 18. But that, forget that for a minute. I want people to weigh in on opposition to the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Weigh in on these nominees. Call Senator Portman and me and your House members. Call all of us. We write emails. Do whatever. The more people are engaged, the more things change. And a month ago, if we had done this interview, Diane, I would have had to predict then that we will not be able to stop the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Today, I think we will stop it. I'm willing to predict that. It's not even close to 100% yet, but it's pretty clear that because people have told their stories, because people have fought back, because so many activists in Greater Cleveland, you remember, just look at the airport rallies,
right,
and look at the Women's March, all that stuff happening. Nobody would have thought that was going to happen a year ago, and people would be that engaged. So keep doing those kinds of things. Demonstrations are important. Marches are important. What's really important is to organize, to tell your members of Congress, both parties, both houses, what you think and what we should do.
Well, thank you so much. I know you have a million things to do today. I really appreciate you talking with me. I hope to see you this spring out at maybe the Bike Summit.
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks.
Appreciate
bye-bye. Yeah. Bye. Senator Sherrod Brown joined me from the radio station on Capitol Hill, evidently. Always interesting to speak with him. He certainly had some harsh words for the president, and he had some good words for us. Contact your legislators. We're going to take a real quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Promised, we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to head down to Kentucky and catch up with show producer Don Walker. Hi, Don. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me today.
Diane, thanks for having me again.
It's always my pleasure, and it's countdown to NABs. I wanted to check in, as we usually do, and learn what's new for 2017. So this is NABs number
13.
Wow, lucky 13. I love 13.
It's lucky for the Irish, as you know what I'm told.
Well, that's a good thing, because that's like right for you and Tim, right?
Yeah, well, I'm more Scottish than Irish.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Tim O'Donnell, yeah, definitely Irish.
For sure. So you chose Salt Lake City this year. I believe it's the first time the show's been in Utah. How's the response been to the venue so far?
Doing really well. The Salt Palace is a great venue. The entryway is phenomenal. It's got all the bells and whistles that one would want for a bike show. They've hosted Outdoor Retailer, and that's always done well there. So we're really excited. Salt Lake City is a great outdoor town. You know, obviously, just a few miles to the east of Salt Lake City is the Wasatch Range, where they've got mountain biking and skiing and snowboarding and any other kind of winter sport you could ever want, you know. And then obviously you go a little farther south in the state, and you've got Moab. So great biking state. You know, we expect good response.
Good. So, you know, the show has changed. It's gotten so much bigger and lots of sponsors and lots of exhibitors. What do you think keeps the concept of the handmade show so popular?
Probably the dedication of work by the staff. We've really, this year stepped up our PR efforts. I've hired Billy Sinkford of Echoes Communications, and I've hired Stephen Elms, formerly of Independent Fabrication. And these guys have been busting their butts trying to, get the word out that handmade bikes are, I don't know how to exactly say it, but, we're not a passing phase or passing fancy. We are legit. We're going to be around for a long time, and the industry is getting, more and more behind us, it seems.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's true. So I want to talk a little bit about the different bikes right now. When we originally looked at the handmade bike world, it was basically road bikes. And now it seems like the focus has shifted to things like fat bikes and gravel bikes. Have these trends changed or added to your competition categories? So have you had to expand your categories to include these?
Actually, yes and no. We expanded to a gravel category because gravel really is different from cyclocross. It's a whole different kind of bike. I mean, they may look similar, but looks really can be deceiving in this case. Fat bikes fall under mountain bikes for the most part, so they still are under that. We have not added a separate fat bike category, but we have added a gravel category.
So one of the things, I was looking over your website, and I have to say, there are some really interesting changes in terms of people's humor. People are really funny in the bike business, don't you know? For example, Kirk's Pinewood Derby bike, which was built for Carl Strong, and Chris McGovern's description of his job as janitor of the company. So, I mean, humor seems to be a big thing for the Handmade Show.
All these builders are very individualistic, and they all have varying degrees of senses of humor. So you're going to be all over the gamut for some of the descriptions and some of the names of the bikes. Sadly, Nate Picklow of Love Bikes passed away late last year, but some of his paint jobs that he named his bikes were just hysterical. He had one that was, you know, "You're My Boy, Blue," and that was from the movie, Will Ferrell movie, Old School.
Oh, that's right. You're a big movie buff. I forget that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm all into movies. Yeah, these guys are all you know, I don't want to say a laugh a minute, you know, probably several laughs a minute.
Yeah, probably. Tell me a little bit about Metier Velo.
You know, I don't know a whole lot about them, actually, other than they are doing some carbon fiber. I've met them one time at, I believe, the Sacramento show, and looked like they were doing some really quality stuff, but I don't know too much about them other than that.
Well, I know that they're saying they're doing a lot of 3D printing of some of their stuff, and I think that's really fascinating. I hope they bring some of their 3D stuff with them. That'll be interesting, yeah?
Oh, I'm sure they will. That's the thing about NABS is you're going to be bringing, you know, the stuff that you want to cause the shockwave with. So 3D printing seems to be a trend lately. So that's, you know, I'm sure they're going to bring something like that.
Do you have a special bike this year, as you usually do?
Actually, I probably have two or three special bikes. I can't give one of them away, but I will just say this, that 1988 has been reborn.
Cool.
I'll just leave it at that.
That's pretty good.
Then the other, I guess I can probably let the cat out of the bag. I'm sure you know who Nelson Vale is, right?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't know Nelson personally, but great guy. He and I had several conversations over the past 4, 5, 6, 7 years, whatever. Just, you know, he's getting back in his bike, and then he started a ride with Nelly. And then I had kind of mentioned to him, I said, hey, you know, if you ever entertain, you know, getting on the track again, you let me know and I'll build your bike. And in the fall, he was at the Raleigh headquarters there in Seattle and called me up and said, hey, remember that conversation when you said this? And I said, yeah. And I go, well, Raleigh wants to have you build me a couple of bikes. So I am subcontracting, I guess it would be for Raleigh, to make a replica of Nelson's 1984 silver medal bike, and then I am actually making him a modern sprint bike. So I am excited beyond belief. I am honored, and this, to me, is, you know, one of those things that this kind of thing only happens when you have a great relationship with somebody. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not like you're an unknown guy and they just pick you out of the blue. You know, this is something that cultivated from a great friendship. So I am just so honored that, you know, he would consider me and that Raleigh has, approached me and, you know, said, yes, let's do this. We're excited about it, too. So, yeah, this is really, you know, kind of, I guess, a pinnacle of my career thus far.
Well, I don't know. Your career's been pretty out there, you know. But it's true. Nelson Bales is one of my all-time favorites. And we've had him on the show. I see him at the shows. He's just a really cool guy. So this is kind of a sad question. I know that we lost Jeff Archer last year to a ridiculous pedestrian accident. Has Patrick picked a new judge yet? Do you know?
Patrick and I exchanged emails last week about this. He says, man, I'm struggling to think who, you know, could fill Jeff's shoes. And the obvious pick for me, you know, if it was up to me, was Ron Sutphin of UBI.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
Ron has built virtually thousands of frames. There's not much he doesn't know. There's not much he couldn't do, you know, with his skill set. So he's going to be able to, I think, pick apart any frame construction and go, this is how they did this. I don't particularly think this is a safe way to do it or whatever. So he could kind of debunk, you know, if somebody had done something really outrageous or over the top. And I don't want to use the words rein Patrick back in, but I want to, you know, have more of a pragmatic approach to the judging. Like, hey, this is done really well. This I wouldn't trust or whatever, just to kind of give them a builder's perspective of what is good and what might not be so good, even though it looks good. That would be my pick. You know, I suggested that. I had not heard back from him. He is, you know, definitely, I think, open-minded as to who that that third judge will be. So time will tell who fills those shoes. But yeah, it's such a shame about Jeff.
Well, and then Chris Cagle died this week.
Oh, I didn't even hear that. Oh,
yeah, well,
Lord.
That's because you've had your head buried in the torch, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. I'm going to quote a movie that I probably shouldn't quote here, but there was a movie I'm sure a lot of people saw, you know, with Harrison Ford, part of the Indiana Jones trilogy, where he was talking with, you know, I believe it was Marcus or somebody, it was referencing Marcus. And the comment was, you know, the older we get, the few of us there are.
Yes,
it's
true.
It's really sad because, you know, we're seeing a lot of our colleagues and, you know, not just colleagues, but, you know, friends, pass away. And it's just, it's heartbreaking because, you know, you've reached that point in life where things change. Things change pretty drastically or dramatically, and you know our friends could be there one day and not the next. And
so you have to appreciate them while they're here.
Yeah, you know,
that would be nice.
Yeah, love everybody is kind of where I'm at in my life right now. Just you know, everybody, you know, you just got to be positive and send the love out there and make sure everybody knows how you feel about them.
Well, before I let you go, I want you to let our listeners know when NABS is, what the dates are, where the venue is again, and how to find out more about the show.
Sure. Thanks. The North American Handmade Bicycle Show this year, 2017, Salt Lake City, Utah. You can go to nabs.com, NAHBS.com. We've simplified the website address. But also the dates are March 10th through the 12th. I was just on Expedia checking tickets a couple days ago, and depending on where you're flying in from, you could get there for $85 each way to about $200 each way. That might change, obviously, but we're expecting a great show there in Salt Lake City. We've got more media coming than ever before. Like I said, Billy's been doing a great job with getting the media there. Sports Illustrated's coming. Gear Patrol's coming.
Awesome.
There's a rumor that even Playboy might send a writer.
Well, they could send a bunny.
Yeah, they're always appreciated, but, you know, I'd rather have a reporter.
Yeah. All right. On that note, I'm going to let you get back to what you're doing, getting ready for the show. And thanks so much for talking with me, and have a great show in Salt Lake City this year.
Thanks so much, Diane.
Alrighty.
I really appreciate you having me on.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Don Walker joined me from his home in Kentucky, and he is getting ready for the 13th annual North American Handmade Bike Show. We're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Every day, we go about our lives driven by routine. our vision clouded by the very normalcy we take for granted. Countless victims of human trafficking walk among us, invisible. It's time to open our eyes. The Blue Campaign provides a unified voice for those who combat human trafficking, whether it's forced labor, domestic servitude, or the sex trade. Learn what you can do to help by visiting dhs.gov/bluecampaign.
I want to once again punch up Radiothon 2017 with our theme, Staying Alive. We are ready to take your pledge at 216-397-4438, or you can log on to wjcu.org and go through our secure server. Your pledge will help to keep the station in its operating expenses, which have been cut by the college this year. Regardless of how little or how much you're willing to help us out, we appreciate it. We hope you'll take a moment and help support college radio, independent radio, the Outspoken Cyclist, and everything that we do here at WJCU. As promised, our final guest this evening is Greg Seipel. He was the founder of Bike Centennial in 1976. He was also the founder of the Adventure Cycling Association, and he's about to retire after 40-plus years. It's an interesting conversation. We had it right before his birthday, and we wanted to give it to you on this day because it is Radiothon. Here is my conversation with Greg Seipel. Hello, Greg. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Happy early birthday. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. So pleased to be here.
Good. Well, fellow Buckeye, you have contributed so much to our sport of cycling. It's difficult to know where to begin, but I'm going to start with Tazrov because I'm in Ohio. Evidently, you're from Ohio.
Yeah.
It is known as, and I was just looking at the website because we're about ready to launch for 2017. It's the longest running and most significant bicycle event in the history of North America. And it has been an iconic ride in our state in Ohio even before I came to the sport in 1974. Tell us about you and your growing up and about how Tazrov started, the tour of the Scioto River Valley.
The first TOSRV was in 1962, and this was a time that a lot of younger people don't remember, when bicycling was considered just something for children. Bicycles were toys, and when you turned 16, you never looked back. You got in the car, and the bicycle was out of your life. And why was it that my father and I decided to ride from Columbus, Ohio to Portsmouth, a 100-mile day on Saturday and 100 miles back the next day? Well, it was because he was a bicyclist in the 1930s. He was a serious cyclist, and the war interrupted things. He got married. I was born right after the war, and so bicycling was something that he just wasn't involved in anymore. But growing up, I saw his scrapbooks. He had these wonderful scrapbooks, and he had this exotic bicycle in the basement, not like the balloon tire bikes that kids had. And for some reason, I was intrigued with all this, and when he saw my interest, it revived his own interest, and he acquired a couple of multi-speed derailleur bikes and proposed this ride of 100 miles Saturday, 100 miles Sunday, and we didn't know anyone else who would consider going with us on that ride. So it was just the two of us.
How old were you?
I was 16.
Okay.
And that ride was actually in July. It was a hot, muggy July. And the ride actually, for my father, it was difficult for him because he had quit bicycling in his early 20s when he entered the service in World War II. And I think he had it in mind that, you just get on the bike and ride the 100 miles. And meanwhile, he'd become a smoker. He was a little bit overweight, and so it was a little bit of a travail for him. But for me, it was just a lark. Wow. I just thought that was wonderful.
Yeah, 16-year-old kid hops on bike, rides 100 miles 2 days in a row. That's pretty remarkable unto itself. How come you guys picked Mother's Day weekend for the ride? It's always been on Mother's Day weekend.
Well, it hasn't. As I just mentioned, the first one was in
college. Yeah, you did say that.
And then the next year, my father decided he didn't want to go again. I decided I'd like to do this again. And meanwhile, I was making contact with other guys on 10-speed bicycles. I actually run people down. If I saw somebody in a 10-speed, I'd run them down and want to talk bicycles. And I got three guys to go with me. And we went on Easter weekend because it was a three-day weekend, and it was a little easier, homework and such. And then for a while then, it was on Easter weekend. And one of those was a very early Easter weekend, and we had snow, the one POSRV where we had snow. When the tour started to get bigger and bigger, Charlie Pace decided that he wanted to take it over and to organize it. He chose Mother's Day weekend because he discovered that it's a weekend that people would avoid having events because it was Mother's Day weekend. So he wasn't competing with other events down the valley.
Well, it's interesting because I got into the business in 1974, and Tazrev was one of those rides that the moment the entry forms were available, the ride filled up. It was insane back in those days. Now it's changed a little bit over the years, and it isn't as big, but I can remember just thousands of people would do this ride.
Well, it peaked at 6,000. I think that was back in the early 90s. And it was something for my father and I to see it grow from two people to 6,000.
I'll bet it was.
And it's true that we didn't have to do anything to publicize it. We didn't have to get ads or do much. We just sent out those forms, and within 10 days, the tour was full, and you were turning people away.
Right. I can remember that. It was like, well, did you get your Tazrev number yet? What's your number? I can remember that for years. Let's take a little fork in the road, and let's talk about Adventure Cycling Association. You are about to retire after 40 years, and you represent ACA. More than we also have another connection in somebody who is no longer with us, and that is the gentleman who made mirrors.
Oh, Chuck Harris.
Yeah. He was kind of one of these unusual, great cycling guys, too. And I know that Adventure Cycling has featured him in the past. So you've done some amazing things, and you inspired the whole idea of Adventure Cycling Association. Tell us how that all started and why you chose Montana instead of Ohio.
Well, it goes back to Tazrev in that it was very inspiring to us. We were advocates, of course, for cycling, and the tour was this great vehicle for reaching the public and saying, look, all kinds of people can do this, 100 miles in a day, it's fun, it's fulfilling. Meanwhile, I'd met Dan and Liz Burden, and I met June, who later became my wife, and the four of us decided to bicycle from Alaska to Argentina. And it was kind of an extension of this idea of advocacy in that we wanted to show this other aspect of bicycling, not just a day's ride, but a ride where you actually go out expedition style and you're out for months and you're carrying your own gear and you're having this wonderful adventure. And we planned this for a couple of years in the future, and Dan and Liz got married and came out here to Montana to go to school.
Oh.
And then meanwhile, June and I were back east and we were married. And a big component in this was that if we figured if this ride was going to have any effect, if we were going to reach people, we had to have some way for people to know about it. And we got focused on the idea of getting an article in National Geographic magazine, which at the time was had a huge circulation. It was a respected journal. And it went into all these homes across America. We actually did get that article in the magazine. And as we were actually cycling to Argentina, the article was about the first part of the ride, and it appeared when we were in Mexico. So even then, even though we had kind of fulfilled this mission of carrying off this ride and getting this article in National Geographic, I was starting to think ahead again, what more can we do? And I realized the bicentennial was coming up, it just made sense that you could have a big bicycle ride across America for lots and lots of people. So it was almost a combination of POSRV and Hemistour, which is what we called our expedition ride.
What was the distance from Alaska to Argentina? And just in miles, do you remember? I'll bet you do.
Yeah, oh yes, it was 18,272 miles.
Holy smokes. Holy smokes. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Greg Seipel. He is the force behind Adventure Cycling Association. He is retiring after 40 years. I'm going to ask you what you think you're going to do with yourself after you retire a little bit later in our conversation. I wanted to ask you a little more about adventure cycling. after Bike Centennial, which was in 1976. How many people did that ride? Do you remember?
Just getting back, you were asked why we were headquartered in Missoula.
Oh, okay.
It's only because Dan and Liz were out here, so just before Hemis Tour, June and I came out to Missoula because it was just a logical jumping-off point. So we were doing the ride, and Dan and Liz had to leave early because of illness, and so they just came back to Missoula, which had more or less become their home, and that's why we ended up being headquartered here.
Well, it's a beautiful place from what I understand.
Oh, yeah.
I have not been there, and I know that a lot of people go through ACA and they get their pictures taken at headquarters, which is kind of cute. And that brings me to the whole thing with photography and art. Tell us a little bit about your background, because a lot of your work with adventure cycling includes photography and art. What was your education?
Well, my father was a draftsman, and not only did I pick up some passion for bicycling, I also picked up a passion for the graphic arts from him. After high school, I went on to the Columbus College of Art and Design, and I did a four-year course majoring in advertising design.
Very interesting. I know two young people who are now attending the Columbus College of Art and Design. Very well-respected school. And I also went through art school up here in Cleveland for advertising design.
And when I was at CCAD, it was a very small school. It was basically one building. And of course, now it's a campus with lots of buildings. There were about 20 people in my graduating class. And it's been good to have seen the school flourish as it has.
It has, and it's got a great reputation. So what are some of the programs in which you were involved at Adventure Cycling as the organization began to expand and grow? What kinds of things did you bring in besides just travel?
So Dan and Liz, when they had to leave Hemis Tour, which was in 1973, they came back to Missoula. June and I continued to the southern tip of Argentina. Dan and Liz really got things rolling. And for a couple years, it was just them working out of their apartment. And by the time that June and I finished Hemis Tour and got back to Missoula, they were beginning to hire staff, and they had moved the office out of their apartment to an old hotel that hadn't been operating for some years. I immediately applied my graphic arts skills to things. And I've never really been much of a manager. I really enjoy the hands-on work. And the nice thing about graphic design is it involves almost everybody in the organization. And, of course, I had this passion for photography that developed, so I was just wrapped up in almost the work that every department was doing. And it's still what I do today, the graphic parts.
Right, the graphic parts. But Adventure Cycling became way more than just Bike Centennial. I think the maps became one of the most important products, if you want to call it that, of the organization.
Yeah, Bike Centennial was the name of that summer, 1976, and we had developed a route across the United States, the Transamerica Bicycle Trail, trained leaders and signed up all these people, and there were more than 4,000 cyclists that took part that summer. A little under half of them signed up to ride all the way across. Other people rode shorter distances along the route. And it wasn't one big mass of people. There were groups leaving the coast every day over a period of time. And it was set up to be an event. That was all we had in mind, to have this grand event. But when we saw how successful it is, we realized that there should be an organization. There should be more routes. Maybe our little newsletter could become a magazine. We could try different kinds of tours. So we decided to become an organization, not just an event. The move from the name Bike Centennial to Adventure Cycling was almost a name change only. The staff didn't change. The location of the office didn't change. What we were pursuing didn't change. We just changed to a name that made more sense. Bike Centennial made a lot of sense for the bicentennial year, but after that, it didn't convey what we were doing as well.
I want to change gears a little bit and ask you, from your perspective, what do you think has changed the most in bicycle travel over the past 40 years since you started the organization?
Well, I think quality of equipment available. A lot of those people in 76 were riding these off-the-shelf 10-speed bikes, riding in cutoffs and T-shirts. those old aluminum Pletcher racks. And all you needed was a plastic water bottle and a bandana, and off you went. And now there's just such a huge number of kinds of bikes and components and all kinds of specialized clothing, and that's what we tend to see now, a lot more of that. Also, the average age of the bike centennial riders was early 20s, and now it's much higher. And you see that on TOSRV. I know in 1969, 15% of the riders were 16 years old.
Wow.
And now, and of course, the big percentage is 17, 18, 15, 14. And now you look at the numbers for TOSRV, and the average age is much higher. It's up in the perhaps late 40s, 50s. And we've seen the same thing here at Adventure Cycling. The riders who drop in on long tours are often much older. And it's not unusual to see people in their 60s and even early 70s now and again.
So do you think that's a good or a bad thing that we are not seeing young, maybe there is no judgment to have about it, but that we are not seeing a lot of young people coming to the sport of adventure travel by bike?
Well, back in 62, when my father and I went on the first TOSRV, every kid in the neighborhood had a bicycle. It was just an accepted part of life. Every kid had a bike. And now, when the bicycle is, has this dignity and admiration, when you bicycle as an adult, it's not something to deride. It's something to be admired. But you just don't see kids on bikes. And that's the odd thing. It's almost a complete reversal of the situation 50 years ago.
Yeah. In a way, it's sad. I'm hoping that some things change as, the economy changes, as people move back into cities, not so much suburban life where, there are no places to ride sometimes in the suburbs. And parents seem to be reluctant to let their kids out of their sight, which is another issue.
And another thing I think that changes that in those early days, no one ever thought to do anything on behalf of bicyclists. Now, a place like Missoula, we have four now, bike ped bridges. There's all kinds of separate paths. There are bike racks everywhere. The city has people who are actually employed to help accommodate bicycling matters, and that's really good to see.
It still does not bring young people into the sport, but maybe it will with, I don't know what needs to change, maybe some education in school. That might help. I know you're going to retire. Is it just a word? Do you plan on doing something that has nothing to do with the ACA?
Well, I will still be associated with the organization. Sometimes I think of it of the organization as a child, and the child has grown up and is leaving home, and I'll still be interested in what kind of friends the child has, and I hope that I get invited over now again. But one of the things that I'm especially concerned about is over the years, we've accumulated a wonderful archive of materials, and I'm the one who's collected these things, but I've neglected the organization of them. So we have all these things that are in disarray, and I'm hoping in the future to be able to put this this great archive in proper order.
Well, digitally, things have changed, too. So now you can do things that you couldn't do back in the 60s and 70s with digital archiving and with even with GPS for travel. I mean, there's so much that's changed, not just in equipment, but in how you go places these days.
Of course, most of what we have is paper documents. I don't want to just scan them and digitize them. I think a lot of these documents should be kept in their original form.
Nice. So what kinds of bikes do you own?
Well, I have a cargo bike that I got a couple of years ago. It's real practical for commuting and grocery shopping, and I have my old Schwinn Paramount that I bought in 1967, and not too long ago I got a bike Friday, which is very nice, and that's inspired me to move on to Brompton, and hoping to get a Brompton here soon.
So you like the folding bikes?
Yes. I realized in the first third of my life, my bicycling was very racing-oriented. Big miles, going fast, emulating Tour de France riders. And then the second third was more touring and more casual riding, although including Hemisphere. And the last third, I think, is kind of turned into a practical aspect of bicycling, where you're using it to do practical things and still recreational things, but not on such a grand scale. And so the idea of a 100-mile day doesn't hold much of an appeal anymore.
It's a long way.
Yeah, and a folding bike allows you to travel, and maybe you want to hop onto a bus somewhere, and just makes things a lot easier. Or you take a car trip, and you just have that bike and fold it up in the trunk and pull it out whenever.
So I'm going to ask you to just look at the changes that are happening in government right now and the talk about infrastructure. I don't know what Missoula has in terms of bicycle-friendly stuff going on, although you did say there are more bike paths and that there are people who are concerned with bicycling issues. But do you see that this infrastructure push to make changes will give us more bicycle and pedestrian-friendly roads, bridges, or do you think it's all going to go for automobile travel?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't follow a lot of that very closely, but I know there are strong forces that see everything in terms of automobile traffic. Accommodating automobiles is the ideal, and sometimes the bicycle pedestrians have to nibble around at the edges to try to get something. And I just think it's ironic that here in Missoula, where we have a bicycle-friendly government, that every time someone gets on a bicycle and isn't in a car, it makes a tremendous difference on the wear and tear of that infrastructure. And especially here where a lot of people drive these big, heavy pickup trucks, and they're just tearing up the roads. And they're the very people that resent anything going to bicycles. And really, it helps those drivers if getting people on bikes extend the life of the infrastructure.
It's a good point, one that has not been brought up very often, if at all, one I actually had never heard. I like that. So I'm going to wrap up our conversation with my usual crazy questions. What's your favorite food?
I make my own granola, and I really like that granola, and I kind of fine-tuned it over time with just the right combination of things, and I just like to have that with unflavored, unsweetened yogurt and some fruit cut up in it.
Maybe you should make that the Adventure Cycling Association's recipe of the year.
I'll consider it.
Okay. What kind of music do you and June listen to?
It's an eclectic mix, all kinds of things. I like bluegrass, and especially, and some ethnic music, and it's a wide range of music.
And my last question is always about the critters. Do you have any pets?
Well, we have a standard poodle named Scout, who we never taught to ride in the trailers.
Yeah, I know. Our dogs don't ride in the trailers either. I think they'd be too chicken. I think they'd jump right out. Well, Greg, I wish you a lot of luck. I am both happy and sorry to see you retire. You've been an amazing force at Adventure Cycling Association and for cycling in the U.S., and we appreciate all the years you've put in and all of the ideas you've brought, and I wish you a lot of luck in retirement.
Okay, I hope to see you out on the road somewhere. Maybe I'll pop in on my Brunt.
That would be awesome. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful afternoon, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. My conversation with Greg Seipel was recorded right on the eve of his retirement and also on his birthday. He was the force behind adventure cycling for over 40 years. I'll be interested to see what he does with this treasure trove of paraphernalia and photography, and we will stay in touch with him. I think he will continue to be a driving force somewhere in the background. I can't imagine him really retiring. Anyway, we are about to wrap up the show for this week. I want to give you one last chance, at least for the moment, to get out your credit card and log on to WJCU.org and pledge your support for the Outspoken Cyclist, for the radio station, and for independent college radio. You can also call 216-397-4438. Radiothon will run through a week from tomorrow. February 19th will be our last day. We hope you'll help support us and help us reach our goal. Thank you so much for listening. I want to thank all of our guests, including Roger Byrd, Senator Sherrod Brown, Don Walker, and Greg Seipel. I hope you have a chance to go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.